Welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB, online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until 1, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined today by Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce and Personal Finance Editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from the award-winning This Is Money to talk through some of the stories on their website they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today, as damning as it is delayed, 7 years, £7 million and 600 pages later, we now have a clearer picture of what led to the collapse and subsequent multi-billion pound taxpayer bailout of HBOS. It doesn't make happy reading for former bosses or the regulator.
Banks were rampant, lending money indiscriminately without proper credit checks. HBOS's balance sheet got up to about £213 billion.
But it's not all bad news in the finance industry.
Another step along the way to making banking fairer. So we think this is a really effective way to rebuild our customers' trust.
Find out who's scrapping controversial sales target schemes. A clue for regular listeners, it's not Lloyds. We take a look at the great smart meter ripoff. Fears energy giants will use the device to double the cost of your power when you need it the most. Also today, no early Christmas present, I'm afraid, for savers. NS&I cuts cash ISA to the lowest ever level as new inflation figures show prices are falling, taking the pressure off the Bank of England to raise interest rates anytime soon. But after 2 months of negative inflation, okay, only a smidge at minus 0.1, but should be worried about so-called bad deflation.
You also need to see -1, -2% for quite a period of time before you start to worry about really sort of bad deflation where the economy really is hitting the buffers.
Also, we head to the shops where we reveal the winners and the losers of the supermarket price wars. How the German discounters continue to lure us away from the big four. And we talk expensive cars. £60,000 for a Ford Escort. And Bex's old motor goes up for auction, complete no less, with name-tagged floor mats. A snip at around about £25,000. So on that theme, I want to know, please, your celeb memorabilia. Paid for or by accident? A very good morning, Rachel Rickard-Strauss. A very good morning, Lee Boyce. Rachel, we'll start with you. Your celeb memorabilia. You must have interviewed many celebrities in your time. What have you got to show for it, eh?
Absolutely nothing. I'm just thinking through. I've got nothing. I saw Eddie Redmayne on the tube yesterday. Does that count as a distraction?
Well, if you'd have stolen something from him, you know, maybe if you'd taken his newspaper or something.
I didn't know that we're going to be talking about this today. Otherwise, absolutely, would have asked for a scarf or something. Sorry, I've let the side down.
That's fine.
I haven't nicked anything. I haven't.
Next time you're in, we'll pretend this didn't happen and we'll ask again. But you haven't been left with nothing. You've left us with a plethora of amazing interviews on This Is Money. Of course, Rachel, you can pay me later for that one. Lee, yourself, a football fan. I'm wondering if you've got any perhaps sporting memorabilia.
My most precious bit of memorabilia is actually from old England captain, Essex captain, Graham Gooch. He's got a signed cricket bat and I've got two dishes from the 1991 and the 1992 County Championship win, which he signed the back of. Priceless.
That is, well, I don't know if it is priceless.
I think it is. Graham Gooch is, you know.
Well, you know, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not sure the valuation of a Graham Gooch.
If anyone makes me any offers,
yeah.
I'm on Lee_Boyce on Twitter.
That's how important that is to you, Lee. I do have an Alex Stewart signed book signed to my brother.
Alex Stewart's not quite as good as Graham Gooch.
It's not, neither is the fact that it's signed to my brother and not me either, but I took that one anyway. And I also have a signed Trevor Brooking photo, pride of place as well. Annie Weston, for yourself?
I was once offered half a Sam Hamwich, sandwich, even by Sir David Attenborough.
So starstruck were you? You can't even get the words out now.
And I turned it down. I was like, oh no, thank you very much. He had it in foil. I think he must have made it himself.
You could have had that.
I could have had that. And as you said, I could have put it in formaldehyde. It could have been pride of place in my living room.
How much do you reckon that would have gone for, Lee?
Well, if it was Damien
More
Hirst,
than the Graham Gooch.
£25 million if Damien Hirst got his hands on it.
Easy.
What could have been, Annie?
Yeah, I know. Hannah says she's got an autograph from Lee from Steps.
Oh, I thought you meant I was going to say Lee Boyce. Stay behind afterwards, Lee. I've got a few things for you to sign.
Vic says, I was once given a tissue by Ainsley Harriet. And Jo says she's got a signed LP by Cliff Richard.
Well, these are classics,
legends,
aren't they?
Absolute legends.
Seriously, there's a lot of good stuff in people's homes right now. Annie, how can we find out some more?
Yeah, you can tweet us at Share Radio UK if you can top any of these, or email us at consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk.
Thank you very much, Annie.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio. We're on digital in London, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm here every weekday from 9 until 1. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up, where we run through some of the top stories that they've been looking at over the last 7 days. I'm joined today by Consumer Affairs editor Lee Boyce and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And coming up, banking targets scrapped, savings hit, and 60 grand for a Ford. But first, called the second worst failure in British banking history after RBS. We now know more about the 2008 collapse of HBOS and subsequent multi-billion pound taxpayer bailout. A much delayed report points the finger squarely at the former bosses who face being struck off from working in the city. The £7 million inquiry by the Financial Conduct Authority and Prudential Regulation Authority said the Halifax owner had tried to expand too quickly. Also heavily criticised were regulators. Andrew Bailey is from the PRA.
The story of HBOS is a salutary reminder of the bad consequences of not having consistent and transparent objectives and standards of regulation.
Whistleblower Paul Moore, the former head of regulatory risk at HBOS, was fired in 2004 after warning the board of the bank's risky sales strategy. He spoke to Share Radio straight after the report was released.
The evidence is not just clear but overwhelming. The directors, they simply can't defend the level of detailed evidence in the report. So effectively, the report convicts them, even though it re-refers them for investigation. There's no answer to the evidence in the report. The devil is in the detail, and the detail is in the report. So they're convicted. And the same can be said of the FSA. Now, clearly, the FSA are immune because they're immune by law, but nevertheless, they are convicted. And they, in particular, it's very important this. People keep missing it. But the auditors, the KPMG, the evidence in the report is overwhelming that they must be investigated thoroughly. And I would say that they haven't really got a leg to stand on. There's a distasteful nexus between wealth and power, which has prevented the proper, thorough investigation of the wrongdoing taking place, which has allowed people who've committed wrongdoing to go past the limitation period. But if they think they're going to be allowed to avoid their responsibilities and accountabilities by claiming a technical point, then I think they misread the British public. We're not going to allow it. I'm going to call for a law to be passed that actually removes that limitation period so that they can not just be banned but also be fined because they profited through their wrongdoing, and that is completely unacceptable. Been a long and winding road, 7 years since I went public. You know, it's been a long march to truth and justice. But I do think that the people who did this work, and I must give credit to Andrew Tyree and Deborah Chesworth and the other people who worked on this, have got into the detail. The devil is there, and now is the time for the next chapter, which is to hold these people to account and then rebuild a system that we can be proud of.
Well, that was HBOS whistleblower Paul Moore there. We'll be discussing this a little bit further with the team from This Is Money. But first, Baroness Cramer, who sat on the Parliamentary Commission on Banking Standards, still thinks more needs to be done to regulate the industry.
We've come to a time when the government is trying to row back on some of the protections and safeguards that were put in place following the crisis. Perhaps the most significant move they're making is to reverse the policy that we put in place that said, if you were a senior person in charge, you were presumed to know what was going on in your bank. And now they're going to require the regulator to actually have to prove that. That's going to be a very hard task to empower regulators to really go and dig through these organisations. Because what we saw throughout the whole of our work on the Standards Committee was that senior bankers kind of had a firewall between them and the things that were going wrong in their organisations. They seemed never to know, never to hear, never to see. And so they were able to say, I'm not culpable in this. You might accuse me of incompetence, but I'm certainly not guilty. Totally unacceptable to the public.
So, Rachel Lee, 7 years, £7 million and 600 pages later, this report says, another investigation into the affair was plainly, I quote, in the public interest after a materially flawed original probe that sanctioned just one person. That was Peter Cummings, who headed up the corporate division. But that could all take 2 years, up to 2 years. I'll come to you, Rachel, first. What do you make of the report? Actually, there were two reports yesterday, weren't there?
Yes, as things stand at the moment, I mean, it sounds to me like a story that you'd hear out of some corrupt African country if you sort of take out the detail of it. The idea that a bank could fail, that the people at the helm could deny responsibility or try to diminish that and can still have places high up in other businesses and be trying to get off on some loophole that that you can't hold them responsible for things that happened so long ago, the old statute of limitations. It's almost unbelievable. And so what happens from here is what's important, what will distinguish what might happen in a corrupt country and what happens here. And we have to see people held responsible. Are there not enough chief execs to go round or something? It seems like such a small pool, which is another problem in itself, that there's this merry-go-round of people going round and round, and often their name is Ian, you know, going round the big FTSE companies because it's such a closed group and they're all looking after each other now. They're all saying, you know, Andy Hornby, who's the COO now at Gala Coral, that they're saying, well, he's doing a jolly good job and we're very pleased to have him here. If he's very good because he's taken some lessons from what happened before and he's admitted responsibility, then perhaps he's a very good chief executive, a very good COO. But it's not fair that the taxpayer has suffered, and we still are, and we won't get all of our money back. And for anyone to get off scot-free is gross, and it just reflects so badly on us.
Where are we in terms of the taxpayer and getting our money back?
Well, we won't. I mean, we're selling off Lloyd's shares now under, it depends who you listen to. Osborne says that we're all doing very well. Sort of a matter of how you measure it. But what it did to us and what it did to our economy, and also what it's done to the banking sector in general in terms of confidence in the sector. I mean, honestly, that Bob Diamond could say in 2011 that we should all start giving bankers a break. And even now there are sort of calls. We had Mark Carney having his forum on banking to try and help people to empathise more with bankers and vice versa. We can only do all of that when we can clear up situations like this. And another 2 years is not good enough. What are they doing for 2 years? Bash it out.
So this could go on for quite some time, couldn't it? The FCA warned, though, Lee, about HBOS. Back in 2002, we heard from the whistleblower there, Paul Moore, who'd gone to the board in 2004 and paid for it with his job. Mm-hmm. The FCA saying a year later they were an accident waiting to happen doesn't really sound like too much of an accident. But the regulator came under a lot of criticism in this report.
Yeah, because originally it was the FSA.
FSA.
So I think they almost had to sort of start off with something else because it was just, you know, it didn't act. It didn't do the things that it was there meant to be doing, you know, regulating, looking at the city and seeing what was going on. And I just find it absolutely outrageous that this has taken 7 years for a report. I understand it's a complicated area. You know, it's a 600-page report. As Paul was saying, it's a lot of devil in the detail. So I will be reading through that this weekend, a bit of light bedtime reading, picking through the bones. But it's a very complicated matter. I understand that. 7 years, the report was meant to be out at the end of last year, but it's had to be delayed by another year to give a right of reply to the people that are mentioned in the report, and then another 2-3 years before any action. You're talking 10 years before anything's even happened.
Absolutely.
Most of these people are going to be retiring, earning pretty decent money. Have they been held accountable? Well, I don't think so.
Well, I think Rachel was saying they're now in high-powered jobs. It reminds me, Lee, of the managerial merry-go-round in football, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's really, really similar.
Three managers, senior managers, came out particularly for criticism. Former chief executive Andy Hornby, now, as Rachel pointed out, COO of Gala Coral. Lord Stevenson, that's HBOS's first and only chairman. James Crosby as well, who was Mr Hornby's predecessor, as well as deputy chairman of the FSA, yet to stand down from that role in 2009. But also just taking a look, HBOS Services former Group Finance Director Mike Ellis, now Chairman of Skipton Building Society Benny Higgins, previous Chief Exec of HBOS's retail arm, is now boss of Tesco Bank. Is it fair? Should we go all the way up to the top in collapses like this? Are we likely to see the end, perhaps, of that, the banking equivalent of football's managerial merry-go-round?
Well, they're ultimately responsible. You know, they're the boss, they're the top guy. They get paid handsomely to be keeping an eye on everything.
And in the good days before the crash, then they were the golden boys. We all just thought they were wonderful. Mm. And they were given their knighthoods and they went to all the fancy parties and everyone was so pleased with them because their returns were just astronomical. They're doing very well. Their shareholders were over the moon. Greed blinds in that sense. Mm. Everyone thought, well, they must be geniuses to be able to be returning these sorts of profits to their shareholders. And so the regulator didn't crack down. Shareholders didn't ask questions. Where what was happening, it's so funny, it was just a week ago we were picking over Northern Rock. It's exactly the same story, where we had Halifax, perfectly good building society, made consistent but fairly, by pre-crash standards, fairly low profits because all they did was take money, pay out lower interest than they were lending out the money in mortgages, taking from savers, giving to borrowers, and making their money from that little margin in between. But that didn't make enough money. Halifax looked round at competitors, like, who was it, Abbey at the time, was doing very well, doing all sorts of jiggery pokery with money markets, making money that way, and everyone got on board.
Talking about getting on board, I want to read you just finally one quote in this. Journalist Jeremy Warner saying the ongoing hunt for scapegoats for 2008 is both far too late and largely misses the point. Bankers haven't been sent to jail because they didn't do anything illegal, and bankers haven't been disciplined because they were only part of a politically sanctioned climate of laxity and excess that ran right through the economy from top to bottom. Indeed, financial pundit David Buick says politicians at the time were encouraging lending at dangerous levels.
Banks were rampant in lending money indiscriminately without proper credit checks, as a result of which HBOS's balance sheet got up to about £213 billion.
Now, even the HBOS whistleblower Paul Moore says that the culture has changed. Lee, are we there yet?
I don't know if we're completely there, though. I hope that there's lessons that have been learnt from this. You know, that's what, if there's a light at the end of the tunnel, it's got to be that lessons have been learnt and nothing like this can happen again. The days of reckless lending, you know, appear to be over, really. I mean, if you look at the sort of measures that Bank of England have done, you know, making it more difficult, for example, to get a mortgage, you know, you have to jump through all these hoops with MMR stuff that come out last year. Mm. So you'd like to think that, you know, that side of things have improved. And if you do one thing this weekend, I really recommend watching Inside Job, American documentary that was made a few years ago. Really does nail down. I mean, it's largely based in America, but it's worth watching. It's very similar stuff.
If you've got time between reading that 600-page
Indeed.
Report, obviously. Rachel?
Barclays has just been fined another massive fine for dodgy forex trading. And that was, I think, spanned the period 2009 or 2010 to 2014. It's not over yet. And I think that while there's this level of complexity in banking, and while that's so closely intertwined with retail banking and how it affects consumers in terms of their savings and their borrowing, while it's that confusing and convoluted, I think there's scope for things to go wrong. Regulator often, you know, doesn't seem to have a handle on what's going on. We find out later because it's all so complicated. It all sounds too good to be true because it's such a mess. But banks can sell each other all sorts of mysterious products that no one really understands because they're packaged in strange ways. While we still have that level of complexity, John Kay has written at the FT, has been writing about this a lot, and I'm on his side on this. While you have that level of complexity that people don't understand, there's still room for things to go wrong and for those systems to be abused.
Well, it's all gloom and doom, or is it? Let's bring you some perhaps more positive news from the banking sector. Subject dear to your heart, I know, Lee, and it is sales targets. Now, only last month we were asking whether Lloyds was ramping up its pressure on staff to sell. All comes less than a year after they banned the old-fashioned incentive schemes that reward staff for getting us to buy extra products. It was in response to all those mis-selling scandals that cost the bank billions. Now, some good news for consumers. not from Lloyds, but RBS and NatWest. Now, they've announced as of January next year, they're scrapping target schemes and instead giving employees a 5% pay rise to compensate them. Well, Les Matheson, CEO of Personal and Business Banking at NatWest and RBS, spoke to Share Radio a little bit earlier and told us it's another step along the way to making banking fairer.
The changes that NatWest and the Royal Bank are making is that we are removing all incentives for customer-facing employees in our personal and business banking part of the business. So there will be no incentives. What people will have is they will have a regular base pay. And in fact, what we're doing is we are increasing base salaries to make up for removing any form of incentive. We haven't been pressured in any way. This is an initiative from NatWest and the Royal Bank. It's another step along the way to making banking fairer. So we think that this is a really effective way to rebuild our customers' trust. When you come into the bank in future, you don't need to worry at all about whether the person that you're speaking to is getting any kind of bonus or incentive payment. They won't be. They are a professional person that is receiving a salary like any professional, and the outcome of that meeting and discussion will not affect their compensation in any way.
So, Lee, I'm going to come to you. We've spoken in the past a number of times actually here on this show about Lloyds' target culture. What do you make of this move by NatWest and RBS? A step in the right direction to making banking fairer?
It's most definitely a step in the right direction. So it changed its incentives in 2012, NatWest, to something similar that Lloyds has now, which it brought in at the start of the year, which was rewarding like customer service, which is just another word for pushing products on people, basically. So it is a step in the right way. You know, 5% pay increase for everyone, you know, seems pretty positive. I'm trying to think what's negative about this, and I can't see what is. I mean, you just hope that these call centre staff and this branch staff that have been pressured in the past are no longer getting pressured to do things that they shouldn't be. And lots of banks, I'm getting far less whistleblowers getting in contact with me about branch pressure other than Lloyds. That's all I'm getting now. I don't really get much from other banks.
It's also good for staff, I suppose, in the smaller branches where not a lot of people come in and
they were probably struggling to hit targets, which, you know, I don't know if they were on par with the busier branches, but you'd like to think that it should put more of a level playing field for all staff.
Good luck to them. What Lee has uncovered again and again with Lloyds is that if you take out these incentives, if you don't have staff sometimes forcing these products onto their customers, they don't take them out a lot of the time because they're rubbish.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where the profit margins come from in the retail side. So they can try and do it. That's great. But I wonder what will happen, whether you'll see the same kind of thing creeping back in as we have with Lloyds, just because it's unsustainable not to be making money from
those
things. Well,
that's the thing. Where else is the money going to come from? You said before Lloyds was, the number of sales were down extraordinary.
The figures from the start of the year when it put this customer service stuff in was absolutely astronomical. But what was happening, for example, if you wanted to go into a branch and take out a £5,000 loan, they go away. You know, you can get £15,000. You know, they're incentivized to push more money on people, paid for current accounts. That's going to become a bit more of a scandal, I think, as years go by. People that have been signed up for these current accounts with a monthly fee that people don't use. So all these sort of things, it just comes back and ultimately bites the bank on the bum. You know, it just doesn't make you look like a trustworthy place. And NatWest is saying that this is to regain customer trust. But at the end of the day, I don't think NatWest and RBS are offering particularly good products compared to other banks' building sites at the moment.
I'd like to think that it's no coincidence that it was this week that NatWest announced that the price of its paid for current accounts was going up by £2.
I think the black current account and
platinum, as well.
Yeah. But they've stripped back all sorts of incentives this year. You think that we had the credit card, which was Your Points, which was like a incentive scheme, that's been scrapped. Other current accounts have gone up in price this year. Some of the current accounts, I think, also had some of the perks taken away, like insurance and things being replaced, like a taste card or something, I think, was what's come in. So, you know, you look at the switching stats for current accounts as a bellwether of where people are going, and NatWest, along with a few other of the big banks, seem to be losing customers. So let's see if this brings a call with people and customers are happy not to be pushed products.
Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, also in the studio, Personal Finance Editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. Coming up, the winners and losers of the supermarket price war. But first, no early Christmas present for savers this week. Firstly, hundreds of thousands of NS&I savers have seen interest rates cut on their direct ISA to the lowest rate since the product was introduced in 2008. Then came the latest inflation figures showing CPI held at minus 0.1%. Good for household budgets, but further dampening expectations of a rise in interest rates any time soon. Before we talk about those inflation figures in a few short moments, Lee, tell us a bit more about the NS&I. Why the cut in savings rates?
Yeah, so it's offered this direct ISA for quite a time, actually. It's been at the top of the Best Buy table, you know, probably for the best part of the whole year. So, you know, I could kind of understand if NS&I are going to cut it now because it's so competitive. And, it, you know, these NS&I products don't tend to try and be the most competitive. They tend to offer a sort of good alternative for savers. But unfortunately, at the moment, cash ISAs have just been completely neglected by banks, builder societies, even challenger banks. Mm. Some don't even offer ISAs because they're quite complicated tax-free products to offer. And I think it's really hit the cash ISA market, and all the competition at the moment is just on traditional, straightforward, fixed-rate accounts, one-year, two-year fixes. What's going to happen with ISAs? I just cannot see them offering anything higher. I think they're going to keep falling, if I'm being quite frank with you. There's some changes, tax changes in April, which means your first £1,000, if you're a basic taxpayer, you'll be tax-free anyway. Mm. So that's a lot of people that are going to fall into that.
Where should you be looking instead for the best deals at the moment, Lee?
Well, there's a couple of fairly decent ones that just about beat that NS&I. So if you're looking for somewhere else to move that cash along, Virgin Money and West Bromwich Building Society have got a 1.56% and a 1.55% cash ISA rate for easy access. There's a few, if you're willing to fix for a year, 2 years, you can get a little bit more interest.
But not just cash ISAs. What else is out there?
It was a shame because a couple of weeks ago, Metro Bank really pulled the stops out, launched two fixed rate savings accounts, one which was an 18-month fix at 2.35%. Very, very good rate. If you consider in May, the top 1 year deal was 1.75%. It just went after about 10 days. I think it was just so popular, people would have just swarmed into it. And actually, quite interestingly, James Blower, who's a sort of savings expert, was saying that Metro Bank's looking to float soon. And it was almost like it was just trying to sort of bump up its the cash that it's got holding. So quite interesting moves how these things work. But I think, you know, my gut's telling me that ISAs are going to continue to be a little bit neglected moving forward. I think fixed rates, because they're quite simple offers, these competitors, these challenger banks that are coming out, with a few more launches coming probably in the next 6 months, I think the focus is going to continue to be on that.
Watch out for the tables on your website.
Indeed, yes.
The average price of goods and services continued to fall into the autumn. The UK's inflation rate, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, remained at minus 0.1% in October, driven down by tuition fees at uni, food, tobacco, alcohol, prices plunging on the forecourts as well. Here's our personal finance expert, Ed Bowsher.
This is pretty much what we were expecting, this very, very slight fall in the prices we pay in the shops over the last year. It's interesting that we've had a full 2 months running now of minus 0.1%. This is an annual compared to a year earlier. So it does show that really there's no sign of inflation picking up yet. Equally, I don't think there's any sign of us having what is called a sort of bad deflation, where we see prices falling a lot and that actually feeds through and damages the economy. Partly the fall is so small, but also a lot of the falling inflation is down to the falling oil price, which is kind of like a sort of one-off thing. It's not really fundamental at the heart of the economy, at the heart of monetary policy. And I doubt the oil price is going to fall that much further anyway, and even if it does, it won't persistently keep inflation low, because eventually the oil price will reach a bottom. But you also need to see deflation at a higher level, or a lower level if you like, more like minus 1, minus 2% for quite a period of time before you start to worry about really sort of bad deflation, where the economy really is hitting the buffers.
Well, that was personal finance expert Ed Bowsher there. Rachel, I'm going to come to you. Why should we, firstly, worry about this so-called dangerous deflation?
I don't think that the bad deflation is too much of an issue at the moment. The problem with the so-called bad deflation is that if prices are consistently falling, then people think, well, hang on a minute, why am I going to buy it now when in 6 months it's going to be cheaper, if that's what the sort of ongoing trend has been. And we're so dependent on people buying stuff to keep our economy going that that's very unhelpful. But we see absolutely no signs of this. People are spending, they're getting into more debt than ever. People are still spending a lot. So it doesn't seem to be a problem. And as your interview said, a lot of the factors that are feeding into the low inflation rate are supposed to be temporary. The cost of oil is, we went past 40 cents a barrel.
It dipped to $40 a barrel on Monday. It's gone up a little bit since, but a lot of it has been down to the price of oil, and petrol prices really have come down compared to sort of previous years. So that's a big factor.
Absolutely. Energy costs are down 4.1%. Food and drink prices fell 2.7%. How long can we expect low inflation to continue, do you think?
Well, the idea is that those temporary things will fall out, and then they'll start, inflation will start to go up again. And actually, if you take out all the sort of more changeable things and look at core inflation, it actually climbed by 1.1%. The other thing that traditional CPI, the main inflation figure that we look at, does not take into consideration is property. Seems mad. If you factor that in, inflation went up at 0.7%. Also, I just looked at the comments on our inflation story, and most of them are saying, well, why is it then that everything I buy is just so much more expensive? So these temporary things are likely to fall out, and then we'll still see inflation.
So not quite a golden time for consumers. I mean, if you listen to politicians, wages up, no interest rate rise expected anytime soon, low inflation, spend, right, Rachel?
It's so frightening, because I think you're absolutely right. I think there is this messaging around spending, and we're all in so much debt already, and it's going to get worse. And we're getting the Bank of England's getting itself into a bind by sort of saying, enjoy it while it lasts, spend, and getting them in a position where they can't raise interest rates because no one will be able to afford it. It'd be crippling.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I was looking at some stats a couple of weeks ago, just about looking at how much people are taking out personal loans, credit cards, really starting to get to levels that we were at before the crisis. It's almost like, have we learned a lesson? And that's before Christmas. And things that are getting pushed onto us now, like Black Friday, which is just one of the most hideous things that's ever, you know, happened in this country. So I like to think that people have learned lessons, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier from 10 years ago, when things really weren't going well. Just remember that. Just always have a bit of a buffer and just, you know, don't overspend is what I would say.
No, absolutely. Well, we talked there about food prices, food and drink falling 2.7% in October, all playing in to these inflation figures. Supermarket price war especially having its impact. But what about its impact on the grocers themselves? Now, as Lidl's introducing its lobster for £4.99 in the run-up to Christmas to lure in the middle-class shoppers, looking at the latest stats, they needn't bother. The German discounters have stolen 10% of the grocery market share from the big boys for the first time, with Aldi even more popular than Waitrose. Now, according to Kantar World Panel, both budget chains have seen big increases in sales in the last quarter. There was particularly bad news for Tesco and Asda, but some pre-festive cheer for Sainsbury's. But before we talk about that, Fraser McEvitt, head of retail and consumer insight at Kantar World Panel, told us some of the reasons behind the discounters' growing success.
I think it dates back to the financial crisis. So at that time, shoppers were under a lot of financial pressure, or worried anyway about their household budgets, and they gave Aldi and Lidl, the so-called discounters, a try. And what they found was that they quite liked them. And Aldi and Lidl would claim that their success is not solely down to that event. They managed to capitalise on it, definitely. So they've opened a lot more stores. And it has to be said, they've become a lot more mainstream. They're no longer just about cheap and cheerful. We now see them stocking some pretty premium products as well. And they like to shout about their quality, not just about their cheap prices.
So, Lee, for every £1 we spend in the supermarkets, 10p is at Aldi and Lidl. So the march continues. But how have they done it in such a short time? Aldi, now bigger than Waitrose. We'll talk more about this report in a moment, but particularly the German discounters.
Yeah, as you're rightly saying there, people are just not embarrassed to go and shop at Aldi and Lidl anymore. It's not a stigma, and it hasn't been for the last, you know, 2 or 3 years. People are finding that it has good quality food, have good offers. And I think my gut feeling is that people are doing the bulk of their shop somewhere like Aldi and Lidl, and then perhaps going somewhere like Waitrose or M&S or, you know, even Tesco to perhaps get things that they might be more used to buying in those types of places. So the growth has been extraordinary in the last, you know, in the last year. I mean, 10% of market share now for Aldi and Lidl. It's really starting to eat into the bigger players. You look at,
well, who were the victims of this, Lee, if you're looking at the
Asda have been the biggest victim of this. I mean, market share's dropped 3.5% compared to last year. It had some results out earlier in the week, which showed again that sales were down heavily in the 3 months. They were down in the last 3 months as well. So really struggling to sort of deal with the onslaught of Aldi and Lidl. And I think, you know, as long as Aldi and Lidl don't try and grow too quickly, because I think there's quite a lot of stores in the pipeline, you know, they probably will continue their march. But where does it end, I think, is what I'm trying to ask.
Well, I agree with you. So Aldi and Lidl lodging planning applications for 171 new stores. That's five times the number of the big four. And Lidl will be the official food supplier to the England football team. We definitely heard that this week. And Aldi is already the official sponsor of Team GB at Rio Olympics. Surely all this stuff is quite expensive. Yeah. How can they continue to expand at this rate? How can they continue to keep prices low?
Well, I think if you look at the size of the stores that they're opening compared to, you know, I think what's happened with places like Asda and Tesco, they've built supermarkets that are just like department stores, are absolutely huge. You know, Aldi and Lidl, they keep it kind of back to basics. It's just like one, you know, level floor. They tend to not have big land space. I think that's probably the biggest complaint that we get from readers, is that actually people struggle to park because the car parking spaces are quite small. So I think they target almost sort of like brownfield, probably quite cheap sites, smaller sites that someone like Asda and Tesco would go for. But interestingly, Tesco, Sainsbury's, where they're actually starting to win a bit bigger now is the small stores, is the ones that are in, you know, cities that you just quickly pop into and buy a couple of bits and get out. You're not doing your main shop, because I think that's how people are starting to shop now.
Rachel, your views?
Their reach is still quite low. It'd be interesting to see what the average distance is from someone's home to a Lidl store versus a Tesco. Everyone's near a Tesco, but Lidl and Aldi, they've got a long way to go until we're talking about saturation. And so long as they keep their business model of three cereals instead of 50 that you might see in Asda, they're just so much more nimble, their margins are higher, they have a long way to go, I think, before they have to start worrying. So long as they keep sentiment on side, all they need is some kind of scandal around, you know, something horse meat styly, something around the quality, because that's why it's working at the moment, is people say, well, hang on a minute, it's so cheap and it's very good value, and so they're happy. As soon as something tarnishes the brand, that's what they have to worry about. But if they continue as they are, and they are talking more about provenance, and they're talking, I mean, they're really at the forefront of talking about working conditions of their employees, if they keep along that strain and keep their brand as positive as it is at the moment, they'll be laughing.
Incidentally, I'm four tube stops down the Northern Line from my closest Aldi or Lidl, whereas Tesco and Sainsbury's are within a 3.5 minute walk. Talking of Tesco and Sainsbury's, Sainsbury's faring well, though, if we're taking a look at these new, just a quick one about them. The only one of the big four chains to increase both share, sales and market share. Why is this possible?
I think perhaps it's just doing things that Asda and Tesco perhaps aren't. I mean, I personally shop at Sainsbury's now. That is probably where I do the bulk of my shopping. I find supermarkets pretty well laid out. We've got a Sainsbury's local. There's actually a Sainsbury's local next to the Tesco Metro, whatever the smaller Tesco's are called. The Sainsbury's is a breath of fresh air compared to Tesco. I can't face going in there.
Mine are next to each other, and I'll always go to the Sainsbury's.
And so I think the Tesco have really got to start looking at some of these stores and saying, well, what's going wrong here? And perhaps they've stopped losing customers.
Well, Tesco's still far and away the biggest, though. But can they turn it around, get back to that dominance that they once had?
For so many years, the USP of Asda and also of Tesco has been price. And they've been beaten on that. Whereas Sainsbury's, yes, it talks about price, but it also talks a lot more about value. I think it only sells free-range eggs, and it only sells fair trade bananas, and it talks a lot more about those sorts of things. Whereas Tesco, until now, has sort of turned its nose up at those sorts of considerations. And I think until Tesco finds some other USP, because it can't do it on price, it has to find something else. If it talks about value it as well and provenance and sort of moves into Sainsbury's space, or if it does something particularly inventive. And there's a lot of scope at the moment for things like shopping online. If it does something interesting in that space, then it could have growth there. Or I think the convenience store setup is going to change a lot over the next 5 years, because there are much lower profit margins on the convenience stores versus the big out-of-town ones, because there's a lot more work that goes into supplying a smaller amount of stuff to a smaller number of people than just these giant out-of-towns. Tesco is one of the earliest players in that market, and already we've seen Morrisons move out of it. We'll probably see others move out as well. If they can kind of claim that space, maybe they've got growth there. But unless they do something very clever, I think they're going to stay in trouble.
Tune into Morning Money from 6 to 9 on Share Radio with me, Sarah Lowther, and Mark Johnson. An in-depth look at the UK and global markets and business, giving you all the day's need to know. Morning Money, getting you ready for the day ahead. Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
And this is Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost on Digital Online and through the Share Radio mobile app, here with you every weekday from 9 until 1. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio for our weekly catch-up, running through some of the top stories they've been investigating on our behalf over the last 7 days. I'm joined today by personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. So far, we've taken a look at our banks and our supermarkets, but now let's turn up the heat and talk energy and the great smart meter rip-off, with energy giants apparently set to double the cost of power at peak times when we need it the most. The $11 billion rollout of the scheme was meant to cut our bills by making them more accurate, encouraging us to switch to better deals. But looking abroad and at a trial by British Gas, this may well not be the case. Rachel, before you tell me more about this investigation, tell us a bit more about smart meters and this big, expensive rollout.
The idea is that everyone who wants one should have a smart meter by 2020. It's a huge infrastructure project. I mean, it's bigger than the Olympics in that sense. It's massive. It's costing a lot of money. And it's the energy suppliers who are responsible for doing it. And there have been all sorts of confusions in that area about who's supposed to be doing what and what their obligations are. And the problem is, this is a very fast-paced tech environment. Things have changed a lot since we first started talking about this rollout. By the time we get them in 2020, who knows? And a lot of the suppliers are saying, well, hang on a minute. By 2020, who really is going to want some little poxy thing in the corner of their room telling them what their energy consumption is when they can get it on their mobile phone?
It'll be done by some app, won't it?
Yeah, everyone's going to have apps if they're the type of people who might be looking at these monitors anyway. And so why is government forcing energy companies to provide them to their customers? But the sentiment behind them seems to make a lot of sense. There is the numbers, it depends who you talk to, but there is evidence that it does encourage people to reduce their energy consumption when they can see precisely what they're using. Mm-hmm. And it's more accurate meter reading, which means that energy companies don't hold on to wads of our cash until they work out what we've actually spent, and even sometimes beyond that.
So tell us a bit more then about the great smart meter rip-off. Charging more at peak times for people using the meter seems a little bit harsh, and to use a favourite phrase of the politicians, on working, hard-working families, because the times they're talking about.
It's true that they could use it in that way. I am much less sceptical about it than Sister Paper Money Mail. I think that...
What are they arguing? What do they reckon is going to happen?
What can happen is, once you've got a meter that's telling you in real time what your consumption is, then energy suppliers can start giving you much smarter tariffs to work with that. So they can say, look, we've got very high demand at this time of day. If you agree not to use energy at that time, when it costs them more money to provide the energy, if you can use energy at different times, then we'll give you a discount. This has been going on for a long time with much simpler tariffs. Such things do currently exist, but as more and more people have smart meters, they'll just get a lot more clever and they can get a lot more complicated as well. In theory, this means that energy suppliers could increase the cost of energy at times when you use it more, because demand is high, it makes sense. But that will be when everyone's watching Coronation Street and running their baths and cooking their dinners.
let's turn our attention, shall we, to we're turning to another story that we've covered recently. And have you ever paid money into the wrong account by accident? Perhaps a slip of the finger on your phone pad, you've mixed up a number, or you've handed out incorrect current account details that have resulted in non-payment. Did you get your money back? If not, well, you're not alone. So, Lee, last month you looked into the case of a Welsh business owner left thousands out of pocket after giving the wrong sort code to a customer. Since then, you've seen a number of readers get in contact with you after you asked them to with something similar. Is that right?
That's correct. So we had the story originally. The guy typed in just like one digit wrong and the sort code, and the cash ended up going to someone else's bank account. It happened in 2013. He's been fighting to get his money back. HSBC said there's just nothing further they can do. The money's gone into the account. They've tried to contact the person where the money's gone, but they don't have the power to just simply take the money back. And I think a lot of people have been in touch worried about that, because they, you know, naturally you think, well, if you accidentally sent the cash to a very slightly, no, it's wrong, but one digit of a sort code, you probably think, well, you know, it'll bounce back or get it back. Well, actually, what we found is that people have the same account numbers. They just have different sort codes. That's
that
quite
was
scary.
Shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite scary. So this case here, the reason why I followed this up is because at the tail end of last year, HSBC rewrote its terms and conditions, which promised that it would help its customers get their money back if it went elsewhere, if it went walkabout. So this business got in touch, done a similar thing, you know, just over $2,000 a couple of months ago. But HSBC, you know, simply said, we might be able to get your money back. The guy involved in this just wasn't getting the right answers from HSBC. They weren't contacting him. You know, it was one of those worries. It's $2,000. Yeah, you want that money back.
Of course.
And HSBC just didn't seem to really care that much, even though they've got these new terms and conditions, which they say will, you know, within 10 days, take the money back if it's wrong. Since we've stepped in, they have got the money back and it's gone back into the account. But I think it's just worry. It's a worry. And all I can say, and as our readers rightly point out, if you just, you know, put through a test amount of £5 just to make sure it goes through to the right person, if it's a new person that you're paying or a new business that you're paying and it goes through and it's all good, then just put the rest through. You know, especially if it's a large sum of money I'm talking about.
Yeah, particularly, I was going to say, because that can be quite difficult. I mean, if you just take a look at some of the stats, trade body the Payments Council report that 19 million electronic payments are made every single day. That's about 7 billion payments a year. Mm-hmm. Even if only one in every 10,000 transactions went awry, it would send more than £42 million worth of electronic payments into a black hole, into others' accounts, and we'll never see it again. So your thoughts on this, Rachel?
I agree with Lee that it doesn't make sense that if the bank knows where the money has gone to and they know that it hasn't gone to the right person, that they don't then have the right to claw it back again. And we're just going to see this more and more people turn to online banking. So easy, slip of the finger and it's done, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, let's turn to our final story, shall we? Hopefully no slips of the fingers when it comes to cars. We are going to be talking about them, and expensive ones at that. £60,000 for a Ford Escort. And David Beckham's old runaround is up for sale. Lee, firstly, I'm going to start with the Ford. I'm no car connoisseur, I'll be honest, but £60,000 seems a teeny bit steep.
So what we're arguing in this is that there was a auction for a 1985 Ford Escort. So you'd recognise an Escort, even if you're not a big car connoisseur. You know, it was synonymous with the Essex boy. And this one was being kept in a pristine condition, and I absolutely love this, that it's been in a carpeted and temperature-controlled garage.
Wow.
To make sure that it's been kept in absolutely top nick. It's done a couple of thousand miles on the clock. And what's happening is people, and I'm sure we've spoken about this on the show before, people are harking back to the cars they had when they were first driving. Simon Lambert, editor, has himself an 80s Peugeot. And this is exactly this. I think people are a bit nostalgic. And if you can get a good condition, even if something as common as a Ford Escort, it's going to go for some good cash. So if you buy a Ford Focus now, stick it in an air-controlled garage, who knows what the future will bring.
Oh, what could have been for my old Peugeot estate? But if you don't fancy the Ford Focus, or you haven't quite got £60,000, but for a cheaper deal, you could snap up David Beckham's old runaround. But should you snap up Golden Balls' bargain old motor, all in the name of a good investment? So a custom Range Rover Sport it is, owned by the ex-England captain, complete with no less name-tagged floor mats, is up for auction. Originally, £100,000 it was worth could potentially be yours for a mere £23,000 to £25,000. Lee, yeah, fancy it?
It's going to auction. I'm going to tell you now, there's absolutely no chance this is going for £23,000. This is going to go, you know, my prediction is it will go over what it was.
Wow.
Georgia, I'm going to tell you now, and you're going to absolutely either love or hate this. We were doing a bit of research on this. Last year, Joey Essex auctioned off his smart car.
Joey Essex.
Yep, a smart car. How much do you think he got for it?
£5,000. I don't know.
£160,000.
£160,000.
And that's Joey Essex. So imagine what David Beckham's going to get for this car. And that's a smart car. Oh, he had signed it. So we're going full circle with the memorabilia. If you want to drive around Joey Essex's signed smart car and you have more than £100,000, I don't know how you... Sorry for the person that's bought that, but I don't know how you live with yourself. But this... actually, to be honest, it's a nice car.
Yeah, it looks all right, doesn't it?
You know, it isn't sort of... I don't know if you've ever seen Stephen Island's personalised Range Rover. It's nothing like that. It's actually fairly classy.
But we've also seen his signed Bentley as well for his wife, which got hearts written on the back of the headrest.
This is actually not a bad car. I mean, I'd drive around in it. It looks quite nice. So, you know, I think it's people love Beckham, don't they? And, you know, you don't know where people were going to be bidding on this from, because he's such a global superstar. You know, unlike Joey Essex, this could be a real bidding frenzy. And what we'll do is we'll let you know next week how much that actually sold for.
Well, I want to know first and foremost, who on earth is Joey Essex? Thank you very much. Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, Personal Finance Editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Share Radio.